Would you describe something like that as the gospel view of money and possessions? You know, your true wealth is in heaven and, and in God, and yet that doesn't prohibit ownership. I mean, does it all add up to something like that?
Yeah, I think money is like having a chimpanzee as a pet.
A chimpanzee as a pet. Okay, yeah.
Okay.
Welcome, everyone, to the Faith Recovery Podcast, where we are seeking to recover faith by recovering the faith.
That's right.
I'm Kent.
And I'm Nathan.
And we're in a series called The Voice of the Shepherd.
Yes.
And we're trying to understand what that would mean to follow the voice of the shepherd in daily life. And the shepherd is the one who gave up his life for us and rose again. Mm-hmm. So we're looking for that message of the gospel in daily life. How does it apply in the situations, circumstances, trials, tribulations of life, opportunities as well? And money is the topic for today. And in a way, that's sort of an opportunity. We have financial challenges, financial stressors. We have financial opportunities. We have money. What to do with it? How does the gospel tell us? What does the gospel tell us to do with our money?
Right. Well, and it dovetails with last time's discussion about career. Did we talk about career last time?
I think so.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because what the decider for many people is potential earning power or whatever, right? And so maybe the way we think about money has a lot to do with the way we think about career. And we use a term that I think, you know, this term kind of lives between the career realm, secular job placement realm, and the religious realm, and that term is vocation. You know, because we talk about what someone's vocation in a secular sense, vocational training and that kind of a thing, but vocation is nearly a sacred word in high church. You know, it has to do with your calling. You know, I'm sure that the word goes back to the idea of being called, right? And so, yeah, back to the career thing, maybe closing that out, but thinking in terms of vocation rather than job or career. And as a believer, you know, we all have a somewhat of a calling on us, but that calling may not be full-time ministry. Maybe it's making all the monies.
Making all the monies.
Right. Because money's not evil, and it can be used well. And
now, do you mean
back to our thing?
Now, I'm sure you would say we're all called to Jesus Christ. We're all called to follow Christ. Mm-hmm. But did you mean we all have a job calling, a work calling?
Yeah, I think a life purpose. I mean, Paul would say, well, if you're called a slave, then your purpose is to be a slave and be a good one, you know. And if you can get out of it, then your purpose is to do something else, you know. But Paul saw God's hand in circumstances, and so he would say, well, your calling is obviously that. And, you know, this, it doesn't do any good to gripe and complain if, let's say, you graduated high school and you got your girlfriend pregnant, you got married, and you felt responsible, and you worked a blue-collar job, and you've just done that for the past 10 years, and you become a Christian, and you start feeling this sense of just dissatisfaction with the grind, coincidentally. And you begin to be sure that God must have something else for you. That doesn't necessarily follow, is all I would say, you know. Paul would say, well, God knew that you and your girlfriend were together and that you know, he's kind of been there all along. It's not like where you are right now is some aberration or something against God's will. The circumstances that you're in are the result of at least God's knowledge and cooperation, even to some degree, in everything that you've done and everything that's brought you to the moment you're in. So it may just be that this is what God has for you. Find what he would have for you at your blue collar job, you know. I think there's a powerful statement that's made when somebody can find joy in the mundane. People will notice because everybody else is just trying to get out of there. You know, working for the weekend or whatever, constantly seeking to mitigate the drain that is the grind of life. And so if you have somebody who seems to be flourishing even in the midst of that, then that says something. So all that to say, that's I may be wrapping up the career conversation. But yeah, money, what do we do with it? such a generic and maybe vague thing. Maybe we should start with kind of the ambiguity that's in Scripture about money.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I don't know, there's a lot of financial ministries out there.
So the ambiguity in Scripture, and I'm thinking, I don't know for sure what it's in your mind when you say that, but I'm thinking, well, in the Old Testament, in the Proverbs and so forth, it's like, you know, money's a blessing, and if you have lots of money, it's because you're blessed, and it's because you're favored. Yeah. Whereas in the New Testament, it's the love of money is a root of evil, all kinds of evils, and, you know, it's more like be generous and give it away and store up wealth for yourselves in heaven.
Yeah, right.
So it's sort of a wealth on earth, wealth in heaven contrast within the Bible.
Yeah, it's kind of, well, and even within the New Testament, you know, you read the Gospels. If all you had were the Gospels, then I think we would be certain that ownership, private ownership of anything is probably a sin. Jesus says, you know, give away what you have, and anyone who doesn't renounce all of his possessions can't enter the kingdom of heaven, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's not too ambiguous, mm-hmm. you know, and yet when we get later into this gospel enterprise, you have wealthy people who become followers of Christ, and they are not told, shuck it, you know, junk it all but Jesus. They're told to be responsible and to care for their household and to be generous and to be ready to give, but also that there's they're allowed to maintain their station, which just doesn't track with what I read in the Gospels, and I could be wrong. I mean, Jesus encounters wealthy people, someone like maybe a Zacchaeus, you know, and Zacchaeus is radically generous or whatever you want to call it, maybe radically penitent in that he offers to give away half of his goods and pay back fourfold anybody he's defrauded. But at the end of the day, he's probably still relatively a very wealthy man, you know. So, you know, Jesus doesn't say, well, that's not good enough, you know, like with the rich young ruler, right? And he says, sell everything you have, give it to the poor, come and follow me. And the ruler's like, no, I can't do it. And Jesus has this, you know, really scathing indictment about the camel through the needle's eye, however you understand that, whether it's an idiom or whether it's actually meant as it sounds. Very difficult for a wealthy person to enter the kingdom, Jesus says. So the Gospels seem to have a pretty clear indictment on wealth and on storing up wealth. I think about the parable Jesus tells of the rich fool who has an abundant year and tears down his barns, builds bigger, stores up, you know, and tells himself, take your ease, right? And the guy's stricken dead, you know. God doesn't seem to have real, I don't know, you know, Jesus and Dave Ramsey, if they were in a conversation, how that would go. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, Dave Ramsey teaches, you know, tithe because the Bible's commands it, and then once you've got that sort of settled between you and God, now pay off your debts and store and amass wealth.
Right. Yeah.
And,
I mean, that's always just been a troubling message. Live like no one else so you can live like no one else, right? And so the promise is to be a millionaire in your 70s, you know, and I'm just like, I just don't get it. And yet, you know, he's a believer, I guess, and he's got, you know, he's using Bible verses. Like you mentioned, things from the Old Testament primarily, you know, the righteous man leaves an inheritance for his children's children, that kind of a thing.
Yeah.
So, and are we going to say, well, those passages are null and void, they don't matter anymore? You know, how do we approach this, I think, from the standpoint of the gospel? If we just had the message of Jesus' death, burial, and resurrection, okay? We'll say the corollary call, I think, that is on someone's life, right? What does that say to us about money? Because I can't go through the Bible and find something consistent. I will always find an exception, somebody I can point to, right? So if And I've been of this ilk, you know. I've lived many years thinking I shouldn't own a car, or, you know, two tunics, you know, or whatever it is, you know. And there's something appealing about that. Like, you know, I wonder how much of the time I spend or people spend kind of playing church, so long as we're very insulated by material goods, that there's something about this raw dependence on God where you have to pray for the bread for today and tomorrow is going to have to take care of itself. Mm-hmm. You know, and Jesus makes these promises that, you know, you're going to be taken up and all that. And there's something, I think, appealing, at least to me, about maybe, you know, seeing Jesus make good on that. Mm-hmm. And the stories of the maybe the spiritual greats, if you will, are people who've tended to rely on God very much. So you think about Mother Teresa. They didn't keep anything past the end of the day. So if they had a package of rubber bands, they would give them out before the end of the day. Mm-hmm. You know, there was nothing materially that came in that wasn't liquidated before the end of the day. Mm-hmm. For them. And someone like George Mueller, who was offered like an endowment and say, you know, let's put away all this money and you can live off the interest and you won't have to just be hanging on a razor's edge all the time, you know. which George Mueller, when he died, I think he had a total of $300 in assets to his name, you know, which back then was probably not a small sum of money, but still not like a bunch of wealth stored up. Mm-hmm. Rich Mullins had a 10 by 10 room. Full of, you know, that's where he lived, and that was everything he owned was in that. So there, you know, I think there are people who've been very serious in their attempt to follow Jesus who generally don't have a lot of wealth. Mm-hmm. But I think that there have been others who have been very wealthy. Maybe they're not as well known or, you know, or well regarded. I think there was a pharmaceutical, a guy that owned a chain of drugstores, Eckert Drugs, and, you know, multimillionaire, but, you know, invested millions and millions of dollars into kingdom causes and things like that. People don't talk about him that much because, you know, it wasn't like he's on his knees asking God for the next, you know, $1,000 so that he could give it to the poor. And yet, you know, he was able to generate wealth and gave God the credit for it. So, you know, what do you do with all that? What do we do with the New Testament material? And Paul, you know, celebrating the fact that Philemon had enough wealth that he could host the church. You know, I mean, this is, if we think the first church, maybe their members were on average 80 people. And you had to have a house large enough for all 80 people to fit in one room. You know, now their architecture was different in that they had kind of an open floor plan and, you know, everything in a great household, you had kind of this plaza area where, you know, it's a big open space and your home wasn't really a private space. You know, people were traveling in and out. It, you know, it was a place of commerce. It was a place of worship, even among the pagans, a large household was. Mm-hmm. You know, there would be an altar to a god and anybody off the street could come and worship the god, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of traffic through these households. But, you know, you had to have a large dwelling and a lot of property in order to host the church. So Paul wasn't like, you know, Philemon, what are you doing hosting the church? You know, why do you still have this big house? Why didn't you already liquidate this? Which is what I think a lot of modern people who try to get to the, you know, quote unquote radical Jesus following, we just tend to go, you know, look side eye anytime anybody buys a thing, you know, and that's been the difficulty for me when I've tried to lean more toward that, you know, that Jesus following approach to money is that I've never been able to get past this notion or this tendency to judge people for what they own or what they buy. Mm-hmm. I don't know. What's been your experience in that?
I don't know that I ever really tried to get that way.
Yeah.
I can't say that was like my goal.
That wasn't your thing. Mm-hmm. You were just kind of more like, this church thing's good. Yeah.
Yeah. I've gone through phases where, I've felt convicted to live more simply, and so on and so forth. And that's come and gone. But I don't think I was ever the kind who was really trying to liquidate. I get that, and I see, and it makes sense, but I don't think I was ever to that point.
Yeah.
I was trying to liquidate everything.
Yeah, and I was wondering, well, how can you be a Christian and not want to do this? You know, and I've talked to people who are very serious Christians, and I was, you know, I was like, hey, what's going on here? And they're just like, you know, I think it's maybe just a different call or something, and it probably is. Like I said, the Bible seems to make room for great generosity, amazing generosity, and also for the retention of one's property, you know? You know, how do we find a unifying principle so that people who are weird like me and you know, just in my history, God's beaten that out of me. I don't think I've ever recovered from his extracting that part of me. I still have very raw and bloody in my soul over the times that he's kind of ripped that away, because it wasn't like he took away something peripheral to my personality, you know. You know, there are times when God's like, hey, you're way too in love with this item, you know. Mm-hmm. So there's probably a couple of things that I really treasure in this world, material, you know, items. One of them would probably be my smoker, mm-hmm. you know. That's probably the only thing, as I think about it. Everything else is like, you want it, you can have it. It's, you know, but let's just say God's like, hey, you love a smoker way too much, and so you just need to give it to this guy, you know. And that would be hard, but it wouldn't, you know, I'd get over it in a few weeks. It's not like something that, but if God takes something that you think is, you know, fundamentally a part of what it means to follow him, and your aspiration is just to be closer to him or to obey him or be the you know, kind of align with the avatar of a believer that you think is out there, right? Mm-hmm. When that's squashed, it's very disorienting. And I don't know if, I've not gotten over it. I don't know if a person can get over it. And so I just take comfort in the victorious limp.
There you go. So you were trying to be like George Mueller and God said no. God said, I'm not calling you to be like George Mueller. And that was very disappointing. You.
Well, and it happened more than once. So I'm married, you know, and my property doesn't just belong to me. So the idea of just going and selling it all is theft to some degree, mm-hmm. right? And so God's just not going to let me do the Robin Hood thing. And so when there were times when, you know, I was just like, you know, we got to get rid of this stuff, and I'm the leader of the house, and we're going to do it. And, you know, my wife, rather than fighting with me about it, she just didn't want to be in this stalemate, you know, with me over this, where I'm just agonizing over it and she's retaining it. So she's like, fine, you know, whatever, we'll sell it. Mm-hmm. And, she, you know, we put it up for sale, and man, you just couldn't give it away. Mm-hmm. You know, a vehicle, our house, you know, there have been times when I've tried to give away half of our income and, you know, just basically waiting for God to come, and you just didn't, you know. So these radical attempts at generosity in my life have not panned out. And I do think that I think God has he would rather not have it if it's given grudgingly.
Mm-hmm.
And that's
you weren't giving grudgingly.
I wasn't, but my wife was, and you know, I'm saying this, I've had to come to terms with the idea that, because before I was like, why are you so fleshly? Why don't you have more faith and all this? And all of those thoughts were more evil than, you know, somebody just thinking, you know, I just want to have a house and a car. Is that wrong? You know? So
your good intentions led you to this judgmental place, mm-hmm. which is no better off than being worldly.
Right. Right. It may be worse. It may be scarier. You know, these high aspirations that live in our souls can become these, you know, something that we will burn the world to the ground for. Mm-hmm. You know, stuff, not so much. Stuff, mm-hmm. we might defend our stuff, mm-hmm. you know, but most of us probably won't destroy another human being for the sake of a car, mm-hmm. you know, but for the sake of an ideal, mm-hmm. you know, I'll wipe out a village. I mean, you know what I'm saying? Like, if this is, and you see that in things like the communist revolutions of the last century, where there's just a willingness to consign millions of people to death for the sake of an ideal. And, you know, I am sympathetic with communism in the sense that I have a real sense of fair play and equity, and I think most people do and should. And there's, you know, Marx made some good points regarding how to reach that. And really, honestly, the abolishment of property is an aspiration to the final culmination of all things. You know, when Jesus comes back, I don't know how many of us are gonna, you know, draw out borders and say, this is my parcel of land or whatever, or we're going to worry about it, you know. You see in the book of Acts where there's this kind of Luke paints the picture of this idyllic kingdom experience here in exile, in the, you know, the already but not yet, as these people, he says, and that, you know, nobody considered any of their goods their own, but they shared and everything, you know, that there's this relinquishing of things that's not directly required and yet seems to almost be an instinct that comes when somebody becomes a follower of Christ.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I went off on a rabbit trail there, but at any rate.
Well, you're talking about the sell your possessions and give to the poor, right? Approach.
Right. There's an ideal.
Money, right? That's a version, right, of a, right, Christian approach to money. And you really identify with it, mm-hmm, and you can, and a person can make a case for it from the Bible. And yet there are contradicting factors in your own life,
right,
and in Scripture,
right,
to that approach.
Right. So what's laudable about the Acts 2, Acts 4 mentions of this liquidating of assets for the sake of relief among the church, the members of the church, okay, where you have this, and we see that, and we go, that's great. And the just unspeakable, you know, horrors of the communist revolutions. I'm reading Gulag Archipelago. I don't know if I can even say that because I'm very, very shallow into the book. But I was reading Colson's Loving God, and he mentions this cornfield, Dr. Cornfield, who's Solzhenitsyn's influence. And so Solzhenitsyn's, I thought, well, you know, here I am. I'm in my 50s. I probably should read this, you know. So I'm at least taking a stab at the abridged version. But yeah, you begin to see what people are capable of doing to each other for the sake of equity, you know,
which is the extreme end version of the just the judgmentalism and contempt,
right,
of that you experienced,
right,
toward other Christians who didn't share your view on possessions and giving them away,
right. Which is, you know, and I know that, like, say, church leaderships and stuff begin to fall victim to maybe movements that call people to this kind of radical generosity, because ultimately, if we don't have members who are radically generous, then we're not going to be able to do as much.
Uh-huh. You know? Yeah, and I don't know. I never really followed David Platt and Radical. I never followed that. I never read that book. But I knew it was a movement, and he was saying something along those lines.
Yeah.
Something like that. Let's be radical and give things away and mm-hmm, you know, adopt children and all the radical things.
Right.
All good things, right, to, you know, serve and love other people. But it seems to have been advocating something like what you're describing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, in my experience, if you really want to mess up a generation of kids, start a movement where adopting children is expected, because you get a lot of messed up kids, because people have adopted this kid because they don't want to be on the outs with their church family, or they don't want to feel like God doesn't love them, and they don't have maybe a genuine concern for the child, and so they, you know, there's very, the child grows up knowing that they're just not, that they're just peripheral, that they're, you know, some sort of accessory to that person's spirituality.
Aspirations to be good, to be, right, radical.
Right. Maybe that's better than being in the system. Maybe, I'm sure it is, but it's not great either, you know, and I've just seen that happen where you'd have a religious movement that they're proving a point. They're saying, we shouldn't allow these kids to go into institutions. The church should step up, and families should adopt, and every family in this church should, you know, have at least one foster kid or adopt one kid out of the system. And that pressure begins to trickle down, and people, you know, that just starts to be everybody's got a, you know, somebody that they didn't birth, right, that they're raising. And boy, the pressure on that kid, on that family, it's difficult, but it speaks to this idea of why, and I've said this before, why freedom is this critical value of the gospel. And so I think that everything has to flow from a place of freedom. And if freedom is somehow impinged or threatened, we've already begun to slide away, no matter what good things, quote unquote, you know, beneficial, positive things that our movement seems to be spinning out. We're still doing great harm, I think, to ourselves and in the world. Mm-hmm. I think about Wild Country. It's a documentary on Netflix about the Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh movement in Oregon. And so here you have somebody that, you know, they're wanting to build this utopian community, this ashram that's built around spiritual ideals and everything. Now, it was something that was quite perverse, and I don't really even recommend watching this show because of how perverse the things they did. But at one point, you know, as part of almost like a PR campaign, they just start collecting homeless people. You know, they start busting them in, you know, to their ashram to as like a PR move. Right. But the problem was, is that these homeless people didn't live like the people in the ashram.
They didn't share the ideals.
Right. Right. Mm-hmm. So the people in the ashram were trying to keep these people placated and peaceful. So their first attempt was to just give them a lot of alcohol, but that didn't turn out well. So they started to put drugs in the alcohol. And so now you have a bunch of people who are nearly catatonic. All these homeless people who are basically drugged into a catatonic state just so that the people in the ashram are not, you know, the natives of the ashram are not being accosted or annoyed or whatever by these homeless people that they've taken in. Finally, they just load them all up in a bus and they drop them in the middle of a small town and, you know, just leave them there. And the small town can't absorb, you know, these few thousand homeless people. And it's just all a disaster, you know, that began with some claim of concern for the fellow man, you know. So all that to say is that Bonhoeffer had a piercing insight. I come back to it all the time. And he says, God hates visionary dreaming. You know, now you've been on church. You've been in church staff. What's one of the things you do if you really want to build?
Oh, you got to have a vision. You got to put it down on paper. It's a vision statement.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. You know, Bill Hybels, Willow Creek, maybe he really brought that thinking into church leadership. And I remember him talking about, you know, he said, a vision is a picture of the future that produces passion in you. You know, as he's trying to help people, church leaders, formulate a vision, you know. But, you know, Bonhoeffer, before Hybels, many, many years before Hybels, issued a warning that that's a very dangerous thing to do. In fact, God hates it when we do that. And yeah, that's I don't know how people hearing this would take that, but it was striking to me and challenging to me because I really like that thinking, the Hybels kind of teaching of having a vision and a mission, kind of rallying people around this picture of the future that produces passion. So that's another way that I got it wrong. You know, you know, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. And that doesn't just mean like procrastination. I think it means that you see something you think is good and you're going to chase it and you're going to get it no matter what, because you're sure it's good. And if somebody opposes it, they're obviously evil and they should be dealt with as such. Mm-hmm. And we see, you know, how that becomes problematic to the simple call to just love our neighbor. So, yeah.
So are you, would you advocate for a certain view? Would you say there's a view that, like, there's a gospel view of possessions and money that says there is a place for making money and having wealth and possessions, but that you hold it loosely and it's not your God, and you live a generous life and you share with others and you're ready to give it all away, but it's not like you have to give it all away. It's just you're prepared to give it all away. Would you describe something like that as the gospel view of money and possessions? You know, your true wealth is in heaven and in God, and yet that doesn't prohibit ownership. I mean, does it all add up to something like that?
Yeah, I think money is like having a chimpanzee as a pet.
A chimpanzee as a pet. Okay, yeah.
Okay, so if you were to tell me, hey, Nathan, Kristen, you know, she's just feeling empty nest, and, you know, dog's just not doing it, and I'm thinking about getting her a chimp. Right?
Yeah.
You know? And, you know, we're just going to raise it. You know, they're going to live, what, 30 years or something. And we've got enough time left. We're not going to leave it to somebody else or whatever. We're going to make sure it's taken care of. And mm-hmm. we're going to hire a trainer. And we're going to make sure it's, you know, it's well cared for. And you'd say, well, you know, what do you think of that? And I'd say, you know, I don't know, Kent. You know, here's the thing about chimps is that they're wild animals, and yeah. and they can tear your arms off, and they'll eat your face just because they don't like you, you know, and you can think it's a good thing, a good idea, right. But it's also dangerous.
It's dangerous, yeah.
Yeah, so you should probably think twice. And I think that's what money is. You know, money is this thing that it might comfort us and make us feel better, but it's inherently dangerous. It is. That there's something about it. And so somebody is free to have it, but they need to know that it's deceitful.
And it's not really because money is. It's really because of the heart. It's really because of sin and the world system and Satan and right. And it just kind of depends on how you are. With money.
Right. But it tends to make us think we aren't susceptible, and that's mm-hmm. why it's dangerous.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's kind of like if you said, you know, I wanted to give up coffee and I thought maybe smoking cigarettes would be a good idea. I'm going to give you lots of analogies here because it's just, I don't want to be declarative about money, but I just want to, you know, and I could say, well, you know, yeah. Sure. I'm not going to say it's wrong to smoke cigarettes. There are a lot of people who might. Grandfather smoked until he was 80 and he lived to 96, you know? I mean, there are times when people can smoke and they're fine, right? Mm-hmm. But if you talk to somebody who smokes and you say, you think this is a good idea? And they're like, yeah, I think it's a good idea. Right? I knew a guy who told me he was like basically a chain smoker. Like he smoked so much that Marlboro had sent him for free, unsolicited, like a leather jacket, a set of luggage. I mean, you spend a lot of money on smokes. Uh-huh. If Marlboro was like, you know, I'm kind of feeling bad about taking all this money, man, here, you know? And this guy contended that smoking is actually good for you because it's exercise for your lungs, having to suck air through that filter, right? Yeah. You see how things that are appealing and comforting and all of that can make us think that we're not addicted to them, that they don't own us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so to me that, the reality, I think what the gospel does is it just tells us that there's a reality to money. You know, did you ever, and I've got to just use this because it's laying here on top and it's good. You saw the musical Fiddler on the Roof?
Yeah.
You remember?
If I Were a Rich Man.
Right. Yeah. So Tevye is, you know, and he's got that Old Testament mentality about money, right? Mm-hmm. But he's also poor, so money means a lot more to him than it does to somebody who's wealthy. Mm-hmm. And so his future son-in-law, Perchik, he's a Marxist. He's going to be a part of the communist revolution under Lenin. Because I guess this is late 18th century, late 1800s, early 1900s, I guess early 1900s Russia, right? And so the Jews have suffered heavily under Tsarist Russia, and they're thinking revolution's a good idea, right? So Perchik at one point says to Tevye, he says, money is the world's curse. And Tevye says, then may the Lord strike me with it, and may I never recover.
Yeah.
But Perchik's not wrong. You know, and that there, money is spoken of as being like a corrosive, right? It says that the rust on your money will eat at you, mm-hmm. right? Be wary of the deceitfulness of riches, right? That so that's what's scary about it, isn't? It's not just that it could be misused by someone whose heart's out of whack, but it could take someone whose heart is very pure and make it out of whack.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why I'm saying it's something we should be wary of, like moving a chimp into our house. Mm-hmm. You know, we might all get along, but it may just be that it's going to at some point, you know, just kill us all.
You come into a lot of money through one means or another. You need to be cautious and careful. You need to be wary,
right?
Because it has this power. And again, it's an inanimate thing, but it's tied in with this system. That involves our hearts and Satan and the world and all of that.
Right. And I'm not aware of a good way to be free of money other than to have at least moments when you give away something that is particularly, well, you know, precious or regarded or a giant sum. I'm mindful of the time before Jesus' crucifixion when the woman comes and she breaks the alabaster jar on him, right? Mm-hmm. And she's criticized for this wastefulness, right? And yet Jesus stands with her. And I think that critique comes from a place of this visionary dreaming. It comes from a place of really regarding money and its potential to do good in the world, maybe beyond what we should.
The critique, the criticism of Jesus.
Yeah.
No, the criticism of the woman.
Yeah.
This woman could have given it to the poor.
Right. Yeah. Right. So we're just saying, hey, that's valuable. You just blown something that's valuable. And Jesus is like, what's more valuable? You know what? Mm-hmm. You guys are somehow out of whack. You know, there's a story of Mother Teresa, and there were some nuns that were supposed to bring her donation of $40,000. Let's say it's from the U.S. And somewhere along the line, they lost that sum of money. They lost that. They, by the time they get to the airport, they're just distraught. And Mother Teresa's like, sisters, what's happened? And, you know, oh, we lost this $40,000. And she says, this is all over money. You know, so whether it's $843 or $40,000, right? You can, mm-hmm. you know, get bent out of shape about money, but it can show something maybe that is out of phase with the kingdom of God in our hearts. Mm-hmm. You know, when we just lament over the loss of, you know, we find out later we could have saved 10% on this item, you know. But I think that the gospel calls us to see this world, as Paul says, as passing away. You know, Randy Alcorn had a book, I think, about money, a short little book. And I think it was related to his book on heaven. But he talked about if you were living in the South, right, toward the end of the Civil War, and you had millions of dollars in Confederate money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and someone allowed, you know, offered to give you an exchange of like 10 cents on the dollar
mm-hmm.
for U.S. Mm-hmm. money. You know, would you take it? Would you feel like you were getting robbed? Would you, you know, I mean, this money is about to be utterly worthless, mm-hmm. right? So what does the gospel say to us about the dollars that we have, you know, or the euros or whatever it is, mm-hmm. you know, that it's just about to become utterly worthless, but we can, as Jesus counsels us to do, lay up treasure. And so there's this matter, I think that money is about wisdom. You know, the gospel is this call, it's this announcement that, hey, this is the beginning of the end for this system.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that our leader renounced it all at the cross. And so there's an a priori renunciation of things. Like you get up every morning and you just say, you know, God, it's all yours. Mm-hmm. But I really think that we can know where our heart is when we have these moments of just biting pain over maybe, say, not getting as good of a deal on a thing. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, when we begin to value money, when it can affect our outlook and everything else, then I think we've begun to depart from the gospel mentality on it. So it really is about us having a shared mentality, a shared reaction to money. So if somebody has a lot of it, but they see it as liquid, they're not, you know, they're not overly concerned about it. They're not just pinching pennies or wondering where every little thing went. They're free with, you know, they're just liberal in the best sense of the word. Then that person, you know, if money just keeps flowing in behind what they give away, then God is using them. I mean, they're a minister of it. And along the way, you know, James says that God is the, you know, Father of heavenly lights. Every good gift comes down from him, and that, you know, that he gives us all things to enjoy. So if some of it is enjoyed, if they buy a nice car or they enjoy a nice meal or whatever, I mean, isn't God good? Can't he lavish on his children, you know, if they acknowledge him and rejoice in him for that? Does not that not also come under the gospel? And the gospel frees us from kind of having these rigid paradigms of if you go on vacation, you're bad, and if you go on a mission trip, you're good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you buy a new device, you're bad. And if you give to, you know, this agency, you're good. And if we begin to create that kind of a template that we use on ourselves and on others, it becomes another legalism. And that's why I'm very wary of the, you know, David Platt's Radical and Francis Chan's Crazy Love. Both of those start to swing into what I would say would be a form of legalism, judgmentalism. I know other people would not share that mentality, but I've been a super legalist, and I've done this a lot, and I know what it looks like when people begin to slide in that direction.
Right. So you're not, and you don't endorse the Dave Ramsey approach.
No.
But neither do you endorse the David Platt approach, right?
Right.
One is sort of this, you know, sort of worldly approach of like just tithe, and after that you know go gangbusters, make as much as you can, save as much as you can. The other is the more radical approach, calling everyone to give it all away.
Right. Well, and it's maybe because it's both of them assume that everybody should enter that pursuit. Mm-hmm. You know, that's, I feel like in a Dave Ramsey course, somebody should stand up and say, you know, why? You know, it's just like he's assuming that everybody wants to be a millionaire, retire a millionaire, you know. To me, that I don't see how that aspiration aligns with the gospel. You know, you may be a millionaire, you may become a millionaire, you know. But I don't think it will be in the aspiration to become a millionaire. You know, Paul says, he warns in 1 Timothy 6, you know, this famous passage about the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. But that's just a little, that's a gem in a larger setting. And the setting is those who desire to become rich, pierce them, you know, have departed the faith and pierced themselves through with many hurts. Okay, it's not a positive endorsement on the aspiration to become wealthy. You know, I just don't see that. At the same time, I think that assuming that everybody has to, you know, sell all they have and everything else, it begins to lead to kind of the Ananias and Sapphira effect.
Mm-hmm. You know, puts pressure, conforming pressure on people to act like, pretend like they're going along, but maybe in fact they're not.
And in their giving, they condemn themselves. Mm-hmm. You know, I think we'll see Ananias and Sapphira in heaven. You know, I think God lovingly kills people before they can find the full extent of the corruption that they've imbibed. Mm-hmm. You know, and Paul suggests that in 1 Corinthians 11, where he says, you know, if you take the supper unworthily, you eat and drink condemnation to yourself. For this reason, many of you are sick and some of you have fallen asleep. Mm-hmm. Because when we're judged by God, it's so that we won't be condemned with the world. Mm-hmm. It seems to suggest that, you know, God might love you enough to kill you before you fall away, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. Which is great. You know, hey, that's his kindness. Which all suggests that, you know, money is, the gospel is the source of wisdom. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 1, he says that Christ has become for us wisdom from God and holiness and righteousness and redemption. You know, that his gospel is our wisdom. And I think that what the gospel says about money is it's going away, right? And your brother is more important. Mm-hmm. You know, that there's something more valuable. It's the, you know, the blood of Christ, and you were purchased by him. And so now everything you are and everything you have belongs to him. You are his steward. Everything under your hand is his. And now your job is to manage it on his behalf. And as a steward, he will allow you a portion of it for your living and to enjoy, right? Mm-hmm. And that he loves us and that he's good, you know. I'm going to give you another vignette. So it used to be when I would go on vacation, it was like I was falling away. Like, you know, like how somebody else would feel if they maybe were an alcoholic or something and they went on a bender for the weekend, right? Mm-hmm. And to do that, you really have to banish all thought of God and just... indulge in yourself, right? Mm-hmm. For me, that's what going on a vacation with my family was like. Like, hey, you know, maybe God won't notice I'm over here, you know? Right? Yeah. And so I certainly didn't want, I didn't want to think about God, and I didn't want to bring him into the conversation or have anything to do with him while I was on vacation.
Because it seemed so godless.
Right, right. Which do you think, you know, was that good or bad? I don't know, right? It's bad, right? It's stupid, right? It's stupid to do. But I was so sure because I had this template that, you know, Christ followers don't go on vacation. That's just an a priori law, right? Mm-hmm. So going on vacation, and I'm not a Christ follower, at least at that moment. He's going to have to forgive me later, mm-hmm. okay? So we went to Disney, right? It's so, you know, it's just such a lavish thing for us to do, right? But we had this moment where Lydia would be old enough to remember it and Caleb would be young enough to still care, right? Yeah. And so there was this moment, like maybe a 2-year span where that was true, right? Mm-hmm. And we'd saved and we'd found these deals on it, you know, and everything. And it was just the right moment to go. And when we get there, everything's terrible the first day. I mean, just everything's bad. You know, I don't know how everything goes bad at the same moment sometimes. But I really feel convicted laying there that after that first day and then that first night, and had this vision of us just as a family on our knees in a circle praying and asking God to bless our time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we did that and man, it just changed everything. It's just like, you know, you just stumble backwards and all of a sudden there's a fireworks show or, you know, there's just a parade here, you know, stuff's just, you just happen to show up in the right place, right time for the whole week. But it's just like every day I just like, God, you know, hey, this is your thing and you love us and I'm just going to accept your love. But that, to me, that's a vignette. It's an example. Like, just like he was against me and getting rid of everything, he was very much for me and going on vacation.
Right. Yeah.
You know? And so, just like we are not supposed to see money as some sort of finite, valuable thing to be hoarded, but something that is, that we ought to be able to just let go of, mm-hmm. you know, be somewhat, and I hate to say reckless, but yeah, I think lovingly reckless with, like the woman with the alabaster jar, mm-hmm. right? Because it's just not, it's going away. It's not worth anything. We might as well use it now, right? We're not going to keep it past our death and in the kingdom of heaven. And so just like that, I think God is the same way with it. God's not like, oh, you know, you can't go on vacation because I was going to use that money for this guy. You know, God's not short on cash. Money is not a finite resource. And so it should always be, I think the gospel calls us to see it as liquid and we can spend it on ourselves, we can waste it, and we can invest it in the kingdom. And wisdom would say that if you want, you know, if you're not stupid, then you're going to invest this corruptible stuff into an eternal reward if you're not stupid. Mm-hmm. But guess what? You're free to be stupid, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. you know, because God loves you, and he's going to let you be stupid. I can't make you not be stupid. And if I tried to make you not be stupid, you'd still be stupid, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and mm-hmm. so somehow, sometimes I think God just lets us learn from our mistakes and even act in ways that are maybe not in our best interest mm-hmm. because he respects our freedom and he insists on us having that, which is a gospel value.
Okay. So now circling back around to career and like, how should I make decisions about making money? Mm-hmm. You know, I wonder how does all this, does this perspective influence your decision about whether to take that job that makes more money or to pursue that career that makes more or less money. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the implication might be clear, but I thought it might be worth sort of spelling that out.
Yeah. Well, I think it's like, you know, we said that it's not wrong to be rich, but the pursuit of wealth is inherently dangerous, like Paul says, right? The one who seeks to be rich departs from the faith and you know, they pierce themselves through with many hurts. So it's in the pursuit, which is why Paul, I think, you know, tells people, be a Christian in the station in which you're called. Like, it's the ambition or the attempt to get a thing that is dangerous more than being in a particular station. So let's say you have a job and you're entry-level management and there's opportunity to move up and make more money along the way. Okay. Now, if I go to work and I entertain that notion, I think, well, this is rung number 2 on the ladder, let's say, you know, and I see that there are at least 5 rungs above me that I want to travel up, you know. and that's going to mean X amount. And I started thinking about, you know, what would I do with that much money, and where would I live, and what kind of car would I drive? And I've already begun to depart. Mm-hmm. You know, that the gospel calls us to gratitude and to peace, to faithfulness, mm-hmm. and that kind of personal ambition is the antithesis of those things. And this is what's always been concerning for me ever since I, you know, got out of it myself. But even like with ministry, you know, a great aspiration would be, you know, if I could just get out of this job, or if I could just make enough money to support my family, have passive income, I could do ministry. Mm-hmm. Man, that's a screwed up idea. You know, you need to repent on that thought before it turns in any kind of actions, mm-hmm. because it's going to create this sense that you can't serve God now, or that particular concessions now will be justified later. And those things are just not gospel values. It's not the approach. You know, I just got today. And if I die for Christ today, then that's good. And so why have these visions and these dreams and let them move me? You know, those are way too mundane for a child of God. Right, an heir of the world, to want this petty promotion or this pittance of a raise when there's this massive amount of wealth that I already own, you know. And so I think that, but I would say that the person who, and I've actually seen this literally in someone's life, there was a guy I knew who was, he was in Walmart, he was in IT. And, you know, he had watched several people who were his junior be promoted past him. He's very frustrated and angry and aspiring to be noticed or to be moved up. And, you know, he reconciled himself to God in some ways and really found gratitude where he was and was immediately promoted. Mm-hmm. You know, that there's something about just being in the moment, being faithful, doing a really good job, that allows a degree of creativity and awareness in a workplace that makes somebody valuable. Mm-hmm. And it's very paradoxical, mm-hmm. you know. If you have somebody who's always clamoring for a promotion and feels like they've been underappreciated and, you know, they're just phoning it in their current tasks because they think that's beneath them and all that, do you want to promote them?
Right.
You know? Mm-hmm. But I think that if where I am is everything, like I'm just fully enjoying, this is the gift, you know,
yeah.
This job is the gift. These tasks are my worship, mm-hmm. you know, and I'm going to do them as unto the Lord. I'm going to offer them. So I'm going to do them in ways that are above and beyond what even somebody who wanted to be a good employee would do them, you know. And I'm going to be very just thankful. I'm going to be overjoyed in these opportunities that I have. That person already has everything, you know, before the promotion. Now, that person is also, I think, very valuable and very promotable, mm-hmm. you know. So it may happen. So I would say that it is that the aspirations are dangerous, not the new opportunities. Mm. So if a new opportunity presents itself, maybe receive it from God. If that new opportunity is 10 times your previous salary, then I think if you're following a kingdom and you're not stupid, you'll think, well, how can I invest this in eternal riches? You know, now if you are stupid, that's okay. And you decide you're going to buy the new house, the new car. I mean, I'm not saying stupid, but and enjoy it and thank God for it. But there is, I think there's a cost to the choices that we make with money, you know, that there's always a consequence. So, you know, there's that much less that we're investing in ourself. There's that much less that we are getting to enjoy in terms of identification with Christ in that regard. You know, Christ was rich and for our sakes became poor, you know, so that there's wealth that's available to us that we might shortchange ourselves out of by choosing to have a thing now, mm-hmm. you know, and maybe we'll learn that, you know, maybe we'll buy everything there is to have and we'll be like, this was stupid, you know, mm-hmm. and cash it out. That would be my hope, that our trend would always be toward wealth. Mm-hmm. Paul says in Galatians 6, and it's a very valuable passage. He says, don't be fooled. God's not mocked.
Yeah.
You know.
What you sow, you reap.
Right. And he says, if you sow to the flesh, you will from the flesh reap decay. Mm-hmm. Everything here is going to decay. Mm-hmm. If you sow to the Spirit, you will from the Spirit reap life, right? Mm-hmm. And so there's something... I think even my soul now is going to pay a price or reap a benefit based on how I use my money. And so it's all self-enforcing. I think that's what Paul's saying, that God is not mocked. Mm-hmm. We don't need to threaten one another or hold something over someone's head. We can just tell them, hey, you know, there's great joy and a dividend available to you through generosity, through radical generosity. There's a great identification with Christ available to you through maybe being downwardly mobile in some ways. You know, you can have that or not. You know, you're not going to have it if you don't invest. You know, if you don't relinquish some items, it's just you're going to, and it's just the law of the universe, of the kingdom. It's not like you're going to be able to be the exception. It's not going to happen. You know, Jesus said, where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. There's not really a way to get around mm-hmm. that law of the universe, that spiritual law. Mm-hmm. It is, or, you know, you either accept it or you don't, but, you know, you're never going to both have treasure here and your heart there. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, it's not going to happen. So I think that as we look at ourselves and as we talk to others, we have to avoid compulsion. You know, Paul's very nuanced. My daughter Christina, she never liked the book of Philemon because she thought Paul was being manipulative. I can see why she would say that, you know, because he said stuff like, you know, and don't worry about it, but, you know, also you owe me your whole life, but, you know, don't worry, you know, it's not a big deal.
Yeah.
You know, but I think Paul is just reminding him of some realities without being heavy-handed and top-down.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, there's a lot at stake in sending Onesimus back. I mean, it's a big faith step for Paul to call Onesimus to go back.
Mm-hmm.
But Paul's betting not just on, he's betting Onesimus's life, not just on God, but on the power of the gospel in Philemon.
Right, yeah.
And will Philemon
receive him back as a brother.
Right. Right, that's a crazy ask. It's a crazy ask for him to send Onesimus back. It's a crazy ask for him to tell Philemon accept him as a brother.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and yet, you know, Paul is inviting Philemon to participate in this gospel. You think about the beauty of that whole thing. If it worked out, we don't know how it went. I'm assuming it went well, just because the letter was retained. But you know, Philemon would have been like, you know, throw it away and then, you know, have Onesimus severely flogged or executed or something. But obviously it was retained. Mm-hmm. So I would say that it was well received. But you just think about the beauty of that, of that redemptive moment where you have something very broken that's happened with Onesimus fleeing for whatever reason and then kept becoming a follower of Christ, totally, you know, remote from Philemon. And then because of his faith, risking his very life to come back, to reverse the wrong that he'd done. I mean, that all of that's just a crazy thing to do. It's a testament, I think. And I think that that's what the gospel is. It's an invitation to really participate in this narrative. And with our money, it's a way we can do it. And we kind of defraud ourselves if we don't.
So. Thank you, Nathan. Yep. Guys, if you got questions, you can always email us to discussion@recoverfaith.org. Thanks again. We'll see you next time.